from KQED. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Mina Kim, in for Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum, conservation efforts are happening in the places we may least expect. That's what the Environmental Defense Fund's Miriam Horn tells us. In her new book, Rancher, Farmer, Fisherman, she journeys along the Mississippi River across America's heartland and introduces us to five men and women doing what she calls the most consequential yet unsung work to address overgrazing, depleted soils, and overfishing. Join our conversation with Miriam Horn next on Forum after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, you're listening to Forum. I'm Mina Kim, in for Michael Krasny. In her new book, Rancher, Farmer, Fisherman, Miriam Horn argues that there's a quiet revolution underway in America's heartland, with tens of thousands of unsung conservationists doing some of the most important work to restore the nation's grasslands, soils, wetlands, and fisheries. She introduces us to five of these conservation heroes, as she calls them, a Montana rancher, a Kansas farmer, a Mississippi riverman, a Louisiana shrimper, and a Gulf fisherman. And in this hour forum, we'll learn how they're finding new ways to restore a mutually sustaining relationship between humans, wildlife, and the land. Miriam Horn is the head of special projects at the Environmental Defense Fund. She's a journalist, and there's a documentary based on her new book, Rancher, Farmer, Fisherman, that's set to air next summer. Welcome to Forum, Miriam Horn.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for being here. I was struck by the fact that the folks that you profiled would not necessarily call themselves environmentalists. Why not?
That's a word that has gotten loaded with a lot of baggage in the last decade or two that it didn't used to carry back in when Richard Nixon was signing all the landmark environmental bills in this country, the Clean Water Act and the Clean Air Act. Environmentalist was a term that was broadly embraced across partisan lines, but in the last decade or two, it's been stamped with this very strong connotation of liberal, coastal, elitist, you know, people with no calluses on their hands. And they just didn't really want the baggage of that word. They're more comfortable with thinking of themselves as conservationists or as stewards. They take this very long view of their responsibility to the land.
And the people that you profiled, they are from the American heartland. I mean, they have ranches and farms and along the Mississippi.
Right. I decided to come down the Mississippi for a few reasons. One, it's as central to the American story as any landscape you can think of. It's the third largest river in the world. It's mud built most of the American continent and most of our topsoils, and those huge estuaries, our biggest wetlands in the country. It was the Louisiana Purchase. It was Lewis and Clark and Huck Finn, the site of many Civil War battles. And it was really where we emerged as a global economic power and where most of our natural wealth really still lies.
And where there are a lot of red states, as you pointed out, and that they did tend to be more conservative.
Well, it is a trip through red state America, and that was not by accident. I really did want to push back against this myth that has been propounded that the only people that care about the environment are people who live in these elitist coastal cities. There is a deep, deep tradition of conservation. The people who live and work on these lands, and in many cases have for four or five generations, know better than anyone that their livelihoods, their ways of life depend on preserving these natural resources.
And you also wanted to, I think, push back on the idea that America is irretrievably broken, as you say, that we're trapped in a more hostile, warring political environment than ever before.
Yes, and I think that's a message that everyone can take heart from right now. It really is not the divided. We feel like a really divided country right now. And spending 3 years out in the heartland, I saw really amazing examples of people still doing the essential work of democracy, people still building bridges across very wide chasms, very wide political chasms, across historic enmities between, you know, loggers and federal bureaucrats and hippies and cowboys, and really coming together to build solutions, to find their common ground, to find the 80% they agree on, and build really durable solutions to the problems that they they share.
So conservation can really be the bridge.
I really think it can. And I think even going forward, you know, there's a lot of justifiable fear about what happens now with policies about the environment. But the voices that are in my book, the voices that EDF works with all the time, you know, these are not outliers. These are representative of thousands and thousands and thousands of traditional conservative Americans who understand how critical it is to protect these resources, who do it out of a sense of patriotism. And I think it really, it's an unexpected bridge, but I think it may well be the bridge in the coming years that brings us back together.
Well, there is fear. You're right. I mean, I saw EDF's statement, the Environmental Defense Fund statement, after Election Day, and I just want to read a little bit where it said, "The election of Donald Trump has profoundly altered the landscape in which environmentalists work. While environmental issues weren't central to the campaign, President-elect Trump took positions during the campaign that were directly counter to ours and contradicted by science. What didn't change last night is our commitment to fight for a cleaner, healthier world. Our resolve is unshaken." So I guess that's what you mean by the justifiable fear. But rather than us focusing on the fear, you want us to focus on where there are opportunities for connection. And so could you start by telling us a little bit about the Kansas industrial scale farmer, Justin Knopf?
Absolutely. So Justin is a fifth generation farmer. His mother's family homesteaded there. They have about 5,000 acres in central Kansas that homesteaded after the Civil War. And that family, like every sod-busting family, spent generations plowing the soil, creating those beautiful black furrows. And the consequence, they had wonderful productivity, but the consequence, the unwitting consequence, was that they actually depleted the fertility in that soil. That turns out that plowing is a terribly destructive thing to do to soil. It strips it naked. It leaves it vulnerable to erosion, as we saw in the Dust Bowl. And it kills, most importantly, it kills the microbial ecology in the soil. So Justin has kind of overseen a revolution on that land. He went off to Kansas State and came to understand the importance of the soil microbes and of protecting them. And so Justin has led his family to really begin, as he says, farming like the prairie. They no longer plow. They no longer remove any of the residue from a previous crop. They leave a big, messy mat on the field to protect the field. It keeps the field cool and moist. And by not plowing, they leave the microbial ecology intact. And so he has managed to really reverse the decline of those soils. He no longer has erosion, and all of the health of that soil, the life in that soil, is really rebounding.
What frequently stops farmers from making the kinds of environmental decisions or conservation decisions we often hear is that it will hurt their bottom line, particularly in the short term. So how has that economic bottom line, you know, been met for him?
Well, you're right. The short term is hard because it requires, first of all, the soil doesn't immediately rebound. And they also do have to really rethink all of their practices, and they have to change their equipment. And, you know, big farm equipment is several hundred thousand dollars. So they started a little bit slowly. They kind of rigged their old equipment to make it work for a while. But in the long term, and they've now been at this for 20 years, in the long term, it's actually a much more economically secure way to farm for them. Because if you look at the yields on other Kansas farms that are still practicing conventional practices, you know, Kansas has had some of the most extreme weather anywhere in the last years, and it's only going to get worse. And if you look at average Kansas yields, they have been as volatile as the weather. They've spiked and plummeted. Justin's yields have stayed very high and very steady all along. It makes for a much more resilient farm against extreme weather and climate change. And so in the long run, it really does provide economic security. And that's a really important message. You know, I do think what people were voting on to a great degree in this election was a sense of economic dislocation and insecurity. But the idea that the way to secure these communities is by gutting environmental policies is just wrong. It's just the way to secure them is to make sure that things like their soil are there for generations to come. That's their economic safety belt.
We're talking with Miriam Horn of the Environmental Defense Fund. She has a new book called Rancher, Farmer, Fisherman, Conservation Heroes of the American Heartland, where she chronicles environmental preservation at the grassroots level in places that you might least expect, like an industrial farm in Kansas. But you say, Miriam Horn, that he is not an outlier, that there are other farmers like him.
There are a lot of farmers like him. Justin took me to a conference in Salina where he lives called the No-Till on the Plains Conference. And there were 2,000 farmers, many of them older than him. They all were large-scale traditional farmers in their overalls and John Deere caps. They weren't kind of back to the land types. And they were all there to understand how to farm in ways that were more protective of their soil and more protective of the atmosphere. They were talking openly about climate change, about how they could be part of the solution for climate change, how they could reduce their reliance on chemicals. And, you know, these were the most traditional farmers you could imagine. There are now about 20% of heartland farmers are now no-tilling. They've now switched to these really restorative practices that Justin is using. So it's a fast-growing movement.
So, you know, from Justin Knopf's farm, let's move west. You met a rancher named Dusty Crary. And you talked about him in the context of Western ranchers being often the staunchest defenders of federal land protections for grizzlies and wolves, which I think is very interesting. So could you just tell us first about Dusty Crary?
So Dusty is a fourth-generation rancher up in the really northwestern Montana. He's on the eastern edge of the Rockies. It's called the Rocky Mountain Front in a town called Shodo, just south of Glacier National Park. And Dusty was a rodeo champion when he was a young man. He was the Montana State Saddle Bronc champion. And he traveled a lot. He was flying around to the big rodeos. And he, growing up, he hadn't realized how unusual a place he lived. The place that he lives is the last great remnant of the American Wild West. It's the last unaltered landscape in the lower 48. It has all of the wild animals that were there when Lewis and Clark came through. And it's gorgeous beyond words. And Dusty really came to appreciate its rarity when he was flying around to the rodeos. And 30 years ago, started to get involved in a string of fights to protect it, starting with fighting back efforts to drill for oil and gas all across these mountains, to recognizing the importance of the private ranches, including his own, and helping to get these huge ranches that sit down in the fertile bottomlands where the animals can take shelter in the winter, to get those protected, and then finally really passing a federal bill to protect the last missing piece of the puzzle. So, you know, one thing everyone in the book has in common is they actually still believe you can be a citizen and shape the, you know, there's a lot of kind of Frank Capra, Mr. Smith goes to Washington here. There's a lot of a conviction still that you can actually shape what happens to this country as a citizen.
And he did a conservation easement. Can you explain what that is?
So a conservation easement is a way that someone who wants to protect their family heritage, Dusty really wanted to make sure that his family ranch stayed intact and was forever a ranch. And so there are various financial strategies, but it's basically a way for a rancher to give up the right to ever subdivide their land or to ever plow it or to ever do surface mining or drain its wetlands in exchange for some financial compensation. And that can come through either a payment from a land trust or it can come through tax benefits.
And I understand we're joined by Dusty Crary right now. Good morning, Dusty Crary.
Good morning. How are you guys?
Great. Thanks so much for joining us. I don't know if you heard a little bit of our conversation, but she was talking about the conservation easement. And I've got to ask you, what were your neighbors' reactions initially when you did this?
You know, there was one in particular that was very outspoken and thought it was, you know, insanity. And most kept their thoughts to themselves. And we were one of the earlier folks to enter into an easement on the front. And I think deep down, a lot of people, it was just fundamentally, you know, not in the cards for them. They just weren't going to go there. But others were always thinking about, you know, the different layers of a piece of property. And I think a lot of them just wanted, they were waiting to see, well, let's see what happens. And I think as a few properties came on and came under easement, and, you know, 5 years down the road, they went, golly, it looks like you know, nothing really changed too much. And then you would maybe talk to a few folks on the phone or and other folks, you know. There was kind of a real flush of quite a few properties came under easement. It was actually kind of a financial strain to try to raise the funds to do this, because most family operations, you know, first ownership, you know, from homestead days, most of them don't have a big tax liability, of course, and so they're more interested in the cash versus new ownership that maybe is looking at, you know, different end games for their property and you know, a tax benefits more to their favor. But so it was a little bit of a challenge, and we worked on an effort to enable U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, which was, you know, they're fairly bureaucratically clumsy in a way, and so we had to go through a lot of red tape and to enable them to purchase easements on the front, as well as some nonprofits, primarily the Nature Conservancy and Montana Land Reliance.
Well, Miriam Horn, you know, wrote about too that there was just sort of this underlying fear that some what was quoted as an environmental or greeny outfit would come and take over the land.
Right. You know, there's and in different, it's interesting, in different parts of the country, there's still a very, you know, strong suspicion that there's a, you know, a deeper underlying, and, you know, the invisible ink just hasn't shown up yet. But really, I think overall, there's fairly good understanding and, you know, of easements, and folks, it's more a question of, you know, it's not for us, we're not interested, or, you know, yeah, we're interested, what can we do?
Yes.
I think there's maybe a little resentment around, because there's just not every acre that's really, unfortunately, interesting for certain conservation aspects, and so I think there's some producers that are in other parts of an area that, you know, there's really not interested in doing. They're kind of like, well, that's a rotten deal, you know. We'd consider one of those, but nobody wants to do one out here in the middle of nowhere. So
interesting. Well, Dusty Crary, Miriam Horn mentioned that one of the things that really motivated you to try to conserve the land and really the land all around you, not just your ranch, right, was the experience you had seeing how much development there was in other places while you were in the rodeo. And but as I was reading the chapter on you, it sounded like your father's death had a very profound effect on your commitment to that as well. Could you just talk a little bit about what happened to your dad and then how that influenced your decision?
Well, yeah, I think all of those things kind of come together. And certainly as you, you know, you get more mature and you get, you know, I was into my 30s and, you know, you certainly start to look around at things a little differently than you, you know, and we were just going 90 miles an hour when you're in your 20s going to the next rodeo and, you know, how much fun can we have today? And, you know, not really worried about anything. And so, you know, you certainly get a little different perspective. And it really wasn't until I got a little bit older that I kind of looked back on and went, wow, this really is getting to be a unique area. I think there probably was a lot of, you know, 50, 60 years ago, there was a lot of Rocky Mountain fronts around the West, and a lot of them have been, you know, seriously altered. I never, you know, really say harmed, repaired, damaged, you know, but they're different. And, you know, whether it's building or industrial type use or whatever. And so that certainly, and then, yeah, when my father was killed on a accident on the ranch here with some livestock, and that certainly, you know, just for a whole host of reasons makes you reflect on, you know, your mortality and where things are going to be and in the future. And so I think that really helped. I'd already really come to the realization that we have something very special here, and we're very lucky and fortunate. And you know, I think when my dad died, that, you know, probably really got me to think, you know, it's, we're just here for a little blip, but the land's going to be here a long time, and I'd like to see this stay whole.
Were you surprised she profiled you as a conservation hero?
You know, it's they're tricky, you know. It started out as this gal just wants to talk to you a little bit, and then about 2 years later, here I am on the phone. So, you know, they
talking to a bunch of folks in the Bay Area. Yeah.
Right, yeah. You know, I was like, oh yeah, because we kind of talked to different folks, and as we, you know, went through different conservation efforts, and I thought it was just somebody maybe wanted to do an article or something, you know, it certainly grew into more, but it's been fun, and it's been great to get to know Miriam and take her on a pack trip in the Bob Marsh Wilderness, and so it's been a really enjoyable experience.
Well, it's been fun to have you on. Thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Oh, thank you.
And take care.
All right. See you, Miriam.
See you, Dusty.
All righty. Bye now.
Bye-bye. That's Dusty Crary, a Montana rancher who's featured in Miriam Horn's book, Rancher, Farmer, Fisherman, Conservation Heroes of the American Heartland. It looks at environmental preservation at the grassroots level. It looks at how there is what she argues, a quiet revolution underway where there are tens of thousands of unsung conservationists in places where folks might not expect in terms of more conservative parts of the U.S. Miriam Horn, one of the things that I found very interesting was the real acute sense of interdependence that the folks you profiled had between each other.
Well, that was one of the reasons that I really wanted to look at this watershed, because a river makes that really literal. But Dusty understands that what he does on his ranch and Justin on his farm absolutely affects what happens to fishermen down in the Mississippi Delta and the Gulf of Mexico. And so they have this long view that Dusty was talking about across time, but also across space. They really feel a sense of responsibility to their neighbors across a very broad geography. You know, and in all these locales, they understand really acutely how much everything that they do. You know, Merritt Lane, who's the Mississippi River man, the CEO of the barge company, says, you know, if I have an accident, I affect everybody else on the river. And so they're constantly thinking in those terms about that sort of mutual responsibility that was really fundamental to us settling that frontier.
Well, I'd like to invite our listeners to join the conversation. What are your questions for Miriam Horn about her book, what she learned from her travels along the Mississippi River? And who are your unsung conservationists? Who do you know that you feel like is doing good work that does not get recognized? Give us a call at 866-733-6786. Again, that's 866-733-6786. You can also email your questions or comments to forum@kqed.org, post them on Facebook or on our website, kqed.org/forum, or you can tweet us. We're at KQED Forum. I'm Mina Kim, in for Michael Krasny. Stay with us. You're listening to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. We're talking with Miriam Horn of the Environmental Defense Fund. Her new book, Rancher, Farmer, Fisherman, Conservation Heroes of the American Heartland, is one where she argues that a quiet revolution is underway where there are thousands of unsung conservationists who are doing what she describes as some of the most important work in the nation to restore our nation's grasslands, soils, rivers, wetlands, and fisheries. And let's hear what our listeners have to say. Rick writes, "The point of view that only liberals are environmentalists is both contrary to history and ridiculous. At least half of the most environmentally friendly presidents have been Republican. My family, largely conservative voters, placed an environmental easement on our farm near the St. Lawrence River. There were few monetary benefits other than the possibility of slightly lower property taxes." And let's hear from Emily in Alameda. Hi, Emily.
Hi. I'm calling. My husband is a marine science technician in the United States Coast Guard. He works in the Bay Area. And he does pollution response and he ensures hazmat does not go shipped improperly. And they are a federal agency and they work on the federal level. And I was just speaking to your producer saying that, you know, it would be very interesting to find a way, I was wondering what the author thought about finding a way to connect the conservationists with the federal organizations that do this kind of work on a better level. I'm excited to read her book because, you know, like the states have to work together because what, like the North Carolina River, the riverkeeper of Cape Fear just wrote an article about traveling the whole river and how, you know, coal ash and livestock waste has just destroyed the rivers since Hurricane Matthew. And I just want to know how to galvanize these people because this is a federal problem. The states need to work together. The states are different parts of the same environment. So I'm just interested in what she thought about, like, maybe how we can galvanize the Coast Guard already doing this work or make the states work together better because, you know, my husband's from North Carolina and he's, you know, it's very upsetting now that the coal ash has infiltrated all the rivers there.
Emily, thanks.
Well, I mean, that really does speak exactly to one of the central themes of the book, that we are really interconnected and that you can't, you know, our atmosphere and our waterways, we all are, each one of our fates is dependent on one another. And there are federal agencies that are in the book that are have been absolutely essential partners to these landowners in the work that they've tried to do. In Dusty's case, he actually took a bill before Congress and got it passed. In Justin's case, he does really prompt the Kansas farmer does work with the Natural Resources Conservation Service that has been an enormous help to him, and also the land grant colleges, which are funded by the U.S. Department of Agriculture, that are absolutely essential to doing the basic science and the research that is helping farmers move to these more sustainable practices. Down in the Mississippi Delta and the Gulf of Mexico, again, the federal government is absolutely at the central of the effort. So they're there, but I agree with you that we need to keep remembering that we are a nation that is tied to one another and that this is our commonwealth, this is our patrimony that we have to work together to protect.
Miriam Horn, could you talk briefly about Sandy Nguyen on the Louisiana Bayou and the efforts that she made to connect her immigrant community with government?
So Sandy is a refugee from the war in Vietnam. She was a little girl, came in the flood of boat people. And most of the community she represents also came in that exodus from the wars in Vietnam and Cambodia. And they settled in the Mississippi Delta, which turned out to be a lot like the Mekong Delta that they had come from. And most of them make their living by shrimping and oystering. And they live way down the bayou south of New Orleans. And they have been on the leading edge of vulnerability really their whole lives. But since they've been in Louisiana, they're the ones that get hammered most, you know, most acutely by the hurricanes that get stronger and stronger, especially Katrina. They're the ones that felt the effects of the BP oil spill most directly and acutely. And as Louisiana is losing its wetlands, and Louisiana has lost 2,000 square miles of wetlands in large measure because of the reengineering of the river that used to continually replenish those wetlands, they're the ones who are literally seeing the ground beneath their feet disappear. Their villages are dissolving into the Gulf. Their fishing waters are turned, their estuaries are turning into just one more bay of the Gulf of Mexico. So Sandy has really worked first to help them navigate all these disasters, but also to be sure that the knowledge they have of this landscape from being out on it every single day of the year for their entire lives, that knowledge is really brought to the table as Louisiana figures out how to reverse this crisis. And Louisiana has this extremely ambitious plan, $50 billion plan for the largest environmental restoration in history that will use the river again. It will release the river again to begin rebuilding its wetlands. And so Sandy is right there in the center of that, making sure that these most vulnerable populations have a voice in that process. Because, you know, we need the long view, but you also need to recognize that there are people who do have to figure out how they're making their living today and this week.
Right. That we don't have a lot of time.
Right.
And let's hear from Brad in Petaluma. Hi, Brad.
Hello. I just found your point interesting about not all environmentalists are on the left side of the political scale. I am way to the left, and one of my dream jobs, I worked for 4 years on 740 acres on the border of Sonoma County and Napa County, and that 740 acres now is a nature conservancy. It'll be a little while before people can hike on it, but my boss was quite the character, and we just have a grand time. And he's done a wonderful thing. I could never figure out exactly how he squared it with his political beliefs, but he wanted to save that as a wildlife corridor. And it was a joy for me. And I look back on it fondly, and I can't wait to take people up there on hike.
Well, Brad, thanks for that story. A listener tweets, "My heroes are the indigenous tribes and those on the front line of Dakota Access Pipeline especially." And Shelley asks, "Remarkable how it turns out that the people indigenous to the plains were right about how to conserve the land. Has the Environmental Defense Fund considered consulting with the remaining tribes for additional environmentally sound approaches?"
Well, I can tell you that Dusty and Carl, his ranching neighbor, they live very close to the Blackfeet, and they have Dusty rode a lot on the Blackfeet Reservation when he was a kid. They certainly have a very close connection to the Montana tribes, and a lot of Dusty's allies have been involved in a successful effort by the Blackfeet to prevent oil and gas drilling on their land. In terms of actual agricultural practices, I can't say that if we have consulted them on terms of agricultural practices, I don't know it, but it seems like a good idea.
Again, we're talking with Miriam Horan. Her new book is Rancher, Farmer, Fisherman, Conservation Heroes of the American Heartland, where she profiles five stewards of the land who are facing complex challenges, including overgrazing and depleted soils and overfishing. And if you'd like to ask her a question, you can call us at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. You can also share your unsung conservation heroes. And let's go to Kate in Inverness. Hi, Kate.
Hi, good morning. Thank you so much for this absolutely vital conversation. This time, anything is more important to our survival. And I want to celebrate the names of Nancy and Kevin Money of Drake's.
Kate, thanks for calling. You know, we're having difficulty with your line. Wondering if you could try to call us back on a different one, because we'd love to hear from you. And I believe you were talking about Nancy and Kenny Lunny of Drake's Bay. Let me go to Rue in Napa while we wait to see if we can get her back. Hi, Rue.
Hi, how's it going? I just wanted to thank you for the opportunity. I have not got to your book yet, Miriam, but I have been reading The Carbon Farming Solution and wanted to point out some of the farms and ranches in Northern California that I got to experience actually stepping foot on their site through the Permaculture Skill Center and Sebastopol's Farm School program. The Singing Frogs farm, the level of organic matter that they're raising is by percentage points using some of these no-till conservation methods. Donega Markegaard and Eric Markegaard with their grass-fed family beef program or business that they run out of San Mateo County and the Jenner Headlands, as well as Guido Frazzini in Sonoma County with Truegrass Farms, all using holistic management and planned grazing and raising their soil organic matter by percentage points. It's a really inspiring thing, and it's nice to hear the Midwest is also looking and actually employing some of these practices.
Well, Rue, thanks for sharing that.
Yeah, no, that's, I mean, I grew up in California. My first inspiration were farmers in Winters, California, the Rominger family farm, who did some of the earliest no-tilling experiments. California has, you know, as on everything, is a leader and doing the work that the Marine Carbon Project is doing with composting on grasslands. A lot of it is truly inspiring. And thank you for giving a shout out to those deserving producers.
And I think we may have Kate back. Hi, Kate.
Hi, thank you so much. Can
sure.
you hear me better now?
We can, yeah.
Good. I want to celebrate the names of Kevin and Nancy Lunny of Drake's Bay Oysters. Out of the love of their land and the love of human beings, they wanted to create responsible food for human beings and behaved always in only ethical manner and were really treated very, very poorly and run out of business, in fact. And I really feel that they're integrity and tenacity needs to be acknowledged.
Well, Kate, thanks for sharing that on our air. And Denise writes, "My family have been duck hunters in California for three generations, and they work year-round on conservation efforts to provide waterfowl areas on their land in the Central Valley. People rarely think of hunters as conservationists, but they are very involved."
Absolutely. I mean, Teddy Roosevelt was our first great conservation president, and he was inspired a lot by his desire to have hunting grounds out there that were richly populated, and there's still Ducks Unlimited, Trout Unlimited. There are a number of, we call them the hook and bullet crowd, that have been absolutely essential to protecting landscapes, including Dusties. You know, I also want to say that the Drake's Bay story.
Yeah, are you familiar with that story?
I am. And the, I mean, it was part of, you know, I spent a lot of my childhood in enjoying that landscape. And again, it goes to a really central theme of the book, which is that in addition to these people realizing that it's not about us v. them in terms of the rest of Americans, that, you know, that there's more common ground in Americans than there is division, the same is true for our relationship with nature, that it's not about man versus nature here. It's not that you only protect nature by clearing human beings out of it. It's that we are a species among species. We can actually be good citizens of these ecologies. If we're careful in the way that we produce our own food, we can actually have a constructive role in keeping these ecosystems alive. And so the book is very much about these working landscapes that have a place for humans in them.
Miriam, I'd like to ask if you wouldn't mind reading a passage from your book for us. One of the things that really struck me as I was reading it was actually how beautifully written it was. And so I would love to hear you share a little bit of it for our listeners.
Well, thank you. And I would love to. So what I'll read is from the very end of the book, and it's the book ends out in the Gulf of Mexico in those fisheries that primarily the red snapper fishery, with a fisherman named Wayne Werner, who has been really instrumental in reforming federal fishery policy in a way that has brought those fish were hammered almost out of existence down to red snapper got down to 3% of its historic levels, and they brought it really roaring back. And the same kinds of reforms have been brought to a lot of the Pacific fisheries with equally great success. But this is the very last paragraph of the book. It is just a few hundred miles from Wayne's favorite fishing spots here to Havana, Cuba, or the tip of Mexico's Yucatan Peninsula, and just a bit farther still into the Caribbean and Atlantic Oceans, distances readily crossed by sharks and manatees, or the larvae and eggs of grouper, snapper, parrotfish, damselfish, corals, and shrimps. Here, the interdependencies traced by the Mississippi River flow past America's borders to touch the rest of the world. What the U.S. does in its oceans and atmosphere will foretell those nations' destiny, just as decisions they make will shape ours. These waters, in other words, that began in the mountains above Dusty Crary's ranch, sustaining his cattle and roaming grizzlies and shimmering trout, these waters that traveled through Justin Knopf's prairies, nourishing his parched soils and the wheat the world eats, these waters that filled the banks of the Mississippi, carrying on its writhing back America's history and prosperity, settling into its rich, bountiful, protective bayous to produce most of the fish we eat. These waters that knit together the fortunes of everyone in this book, everyone in the Mississippi watershed, everyone in the nation, extend further still, linking our fortunes to every microbe, grizzly bear, crustacean, weed, finfish, and human on Earth.
Miriam Horn reading from her book, Rancher, Farmer, Fisherman, Conservation Heroes of the American Heartland. Did you get any pushback about, you know, not profiling small organic farmers or something like that?
You know, I've gotten actually surprising little pushback on that. I thought I would get more. I think that there is, across the world of farmers, I think there is a growing recognition that these problems are really complex, and that assuming that there is already a perfect answer that we've figured out, just we don't begin to understand enough about things like soil microbes and soil health, or to really have decided, okay, we know that there's one right perfect way to farm. There isn't a perfect way to farm. And increasingly, producers of all sorts, I think, are really pushing toward figuring out how to take the best of all kinds of practices and how to continually keep challenging themselves to be better. So actually, I've found mostly people really open to learning everything they can to be better producers.
And let's hear more from our listeners. Again, that number, 866-733-6786. Vern in San Jose. Hi, Vern.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to kind of make the point. It's awfully hard to pigeonhole people, parties, et cetera. But I think there's a sort of a false equivalency sort of thing going on today, which is the Republican Party has moved so far to the right that people like Nixon and all those kinds of people who did sign some good legislation would no longer probably be members of today's Republican Party. So I just think that's an important point to make, that even George Will, incredibly conservative Republican columnist, left the Republican Party, as did many others in this past election, because they recognize that's not their party anymore.
Thanks for making that point. What do you think, Miriam Horn?
Well, I mean, I think there's no question that the Republican Party is split in some fundamental ways within itself and trying to figure out who it's going to be in this new world. I mean, there are tremendous numbers still of Republican leaders on the environment, and especially Republican support for especially climate action. And, you know, it's really a generational shift. So if you look at millennial Republicans, the support for clean energy and for action on climate change is extremely strong. So, I mean, I agree that the Republican Party is not what any of us imagined it was going to be with the dust settling on this election. But I think I'm hopeful that when it kind of figures out who it is, it recovers some of these really deep traditions in the party that carry through. I mean, Ronald Reagan, after all, was the one who signed the first global treaty protecting the atmosphere, the Montreal Protocol that tackled the hole in the ozone. And, you know, if Ronald Reagan can do it, surely any Republican can.
Well, what was it like for Dusty Crary, who you described in the book as being pretty conservative, and he had President Obama sign his, you know, the Rocky Mountain Front Heritage Act in 2014?
Well, he's gotten some grief from some of his liberal neighbors, have teased him. He also was part of the America Great Outdoors Initiative. And so there's a picture of Dusty looking really sharp in his suit standing behind Obama at the launch of that. And he's gotten kind of no end of grief about that. But one of the things that I loved about hanging out with him and his friends is that they're actually pretty open about how different their politics are. They run the gamut from, you know, he calls his partner Gene Sense a liberal old beatnik, and Gene was in the Peace Corps, and he would be recognizable in the Bay Area, and, you know, and then to all the way to Carl Rappold, who I don't think has ever voted anyway but Republican. And they're open about it, but they don't let it splinter them. It really, you know, even the teasing about it pulls them together. And I mean, Dusty says he thinks of the political parties as like two cable choices, that there's like one thing you want and the rest is kind of junk that you have to take with the rest of it.
Well, Ben writes, a shout out to Joe McBride, UC Berkeley professor of landscape architecture and environmental planning. He's been an inspiration for students over four decades, and he still walks the streets of Berkeley tending to the urban forest. Joe sees the interconnectedness of everything in a pragmatic and scientific way that is accessible for people of all political bents. And let's hear from Thomas in Los Gatos. Hi, Thomas.
Well, hi. I just wanted to mention the Caldwell Marshall County Park in South San Jose, Branham and Snell. It's a big success of preserving the Caldwell Marshall Farm, the open space there, which provides beautiful views of the Santa Cruz Mountains. But they have organic farming there still. But the problem is they overdeveloped the park and drove out the wildlife, which, you know, fed the raptors used to hang out there, clean barn owls and golden eagles even. And also there were a lot of killdeer nesting on the open flats. And they're pretty much endangered, you know, in the South Bay. Because everything has been overdeveloped. They used to, you know, nest on the open salt flats and other broad open spaces, along with, of course, burrowing owls. So it's great to preserve farms, and especially in San Jose, and have the beautiful barn buildings as well preserved, and the beautiful views of, you know, Loma Prieta and Umanum. But not overdevelop and drive out all the wildlife or allow movie companies in too, because they also, you know, they paint the rocks in places like Sanborn County Park. So that's another conservation no-no. Well, keep the movie companies out.
Well, Thomas, thanks for sharing that conservation victory with us. Another listener tweets, a nearby group I've known, Alan, he writes, a nearby group I've known is East Bay Trail Dogs, which works around Mount Diablo to maintain parks and also volunteers to transition old ranch lands to land preserves. Another listener tweets, my unsung conservation hero is my grandpa. He's been on the family about turning off faucets and lights and using the whole buffalo for decades. You know, inevitably with these shows, people would like to know what are the most important choices they could make to help advance the conservation movement?
I mean, I think
in that, small ways,
the,
even
the, yes,
like this,
the,
this
that
grandpa
last tweet gets at it, that, you know, eliminating waste in our lives. I mean, in the food system, it's really really shocking when you discover how much food we throw away. And if you spend time out with these food producers and realize how much of our resources are invested at the front end. I mean, I don't ever throw away food, because if I'm throwing away food, I realize I'm throwing away the water that went to grow that crop and the diesel that powered the tractor and the soil that was given over to it. So that to me, you know, we waste more than a third to a half of all of our food goes in the trash. And so dealing with that and really being careful about not wasting and not wasting water and electricity, I mean, that's enormously critical. You know, California is really, again, leading on figuring out how to make sure that all of those climate impacts really get integrated into the economy. So, I mean, using your political power, I mean, Californians are going to be ever more important in the coming years in sort of holding the ground and making sure that things like fuel economy standards and climate, a cap and trade bill and everything else that you guys have here really keep us moving forward, even if as the federal government lurches about trying to figure out what it's going to do.
It's definitely something that's top of mind, especially for folks in our region. Mark in Larkspur. Hi, Mark.
Hi. I just wanted to call and give a shout out to Dusty Crary's business. He's a horse pack outfitter in Choteau. His company is called Seven Lazy P. And this guy is one of the more interesting people you're ever going to meet. Nothing comes out of his mouth that isn't interesting or entertaining or enlightening. And you can go and meet him and go horse packing with him into the Bob Marshall Wilderness. And if that appeals to you, you couldn't ask for a better outfitter. And I just wanted to mention that this guy is the real deal, and he's accessible. You can go spend a week with him, and you won't be sorry. That's it.
Well, Mark, thanks. Thanks for that. And Miriam Horn, I'm sure you know what he's talking about because you went with him on exploring that whole area. Joe writes, one of the major environmental problems caused by agriculture in the central U.S. is nitrogen from fertilizer and animal waste being washed into streams and flowing down rivers into the Gulf of Mexico or the Great Lakes. This results in pollution and kills fish, crabs, and mollusks. What do you see the Midwest farmers doing about this? It's a great point, Joe. And it's actually something you address in the book.
I do at some length because it's an absolutely critical problem. And there's a few things that farmers like Justin are doing about it. One is Justin never has a field empty. He never leaves anything fallow. If he doesn't have a commercial crop, he grows what's called a cover crop. It's usually a mix of 8 or 10 crops, each of which does something different for the soil. Some might be a radish that creates a nice water pour. Some might have a really broad leaf that shields the soil from pelting raindrops. But a big role that they all play is actually taking up any excess nitrogen out of the soil and holding it in their plant tissues so that it doesn't ever run off into the waterways. They also fix nitrogen. They actually add nitrogen to the soil biologically so that Justin now has to use far less extra nitrogen on his fields per bushel of wheat that he grows. So some of it is about much more careful use of added nitrogen fertilizer. And mostly it's about using biology. That's his mantra, is biology first to solve every problem. So he uses plants, he uses alfalfa and soybeans and other legumes to do the work of fixing the nitrogen in the soil biologically so that he really can ratchet back on the nitrogen he adds. There's also a whole role for these advanced technologies that are coming into agriculture, these precision technologies that allow a farmer now to not just kind of blindly apply nitrogen across a whole field, but to really know from sensors exactly what that little square inch of field needs and apply just that amount of nitrogen at just the right time. And that's really a growing movement across these large agricultural enterprises.
Well, Claire writes, shout out to Pella Hoyt. I hope I'm saying that right. My cousin in Montana doing the good work with Five Valleys Land Trust to create meaningful easements with ranchers and farmers around that great state. Do you know Claire?
I don't.
Or do you know Pella Hoyt?
No.
I think we might have time for one last call. Natalie from Vernon, New Jersey. Hi, Natalie.
Hi. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, go ahead.
So I live in an agricultural region in New Jersey, and used to live in Berkeley. So I read Berkeley Fed, and there was an article in there about an organic clothing company. And I was thinking, you know, everybody's talking about ranching and farming and the big picture and conservation, and nobody's talking about clothing or cotton or all these things that have a major impact on the environment and could have a really positive regenerative impact as well. But I was just wondering what the author and host think about where clothing fits into this picture.
I mean, you're absolutely right that fiber is really important, and cotton is a crop that has a lot of environmental impacts. I don't have a fiber producer in the book, so I probably don't really know enough to say much. But just to really second your sentiment that it is an area of our productive landscapes that we also have to be focused on. And you know, one thing that's kind of universal for all of them is that you really want to sacrifice as little land as possible for the most production. That, you know, any kind of farm is a displacement of a native ecosystem. And so in the same way that cities are environmentally sound because they concentrate the human footprint in where we live and how we travel, you know, a farm that really commits to being highly productive with minimal impact does the same. It spares the rest of nature.
Well, Natalie, thanks for that point. And Miriam Horn, author of Rancher, Farmer, Fisherman, Conservation Heroes of the American Heartland, thank you so much for being with us this morning.
It's been a great pleasure. Thank you for having me.
And I should tell folks that she will be speaking at the Diatribe Foundation in San Francisco tomorrow at 7:30. And the documentary of the same name, Rancher, Farmer, Fisherman, Conservation Heroes of the American Heartland, is set to air on the Discovery Channel in summer of next year, 2017. Forum is produced by Irene Noguchi, Judy Campbell, Tina Lauerberg. Our engineer is Howard Gelman. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. I'm Mina Kim. Thanks for listening.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.